Thank you. So the message from this, the intended message is not, this is a guy who can't keep a job, although when I look at it, that's what it looks like to me. But it's just, I want to let you know, I've been kind of half in the business world and half in the educational or church education world, and it's hard to be in both. And maybe that's what we'll talk a little bit about today. For me, this difficulty started with one of my very first jobs. When I was in high school, I worked pumping gas at a gas station, not exactly this one, but it was an ARCO station. And I was I came from a believing family, so by that time I was I had accepted Christ myself, and so I was interested in this job. Okay, what does it mean, you know, to be a Christian and to be working in this job? And I actually enjoyed it. Maybe not the pumping gas; that's pretty boring. But I got to help out fixing cars a little bit, and that was interesting. And I did like filling LPG, you know, gas tanks. Because I realized a lot of the poor people in the little town I grew up in cooked with LPG gas, and so every time I filled somebody's gas cylinder, I realized, gosh, I'm helping her. You know, I'm helping her. It was always women who came in to get them filled. I'm helping her, you know, make dinner for her family. I kind of like that. I like cleaning restrooms, believe it or not, because I like the cleanliness afterwards. And one thing I really loved was being responsible for the till. And pretty quickly, the owner realized that of all the 16 and 17-year-olds, I was the only one who could be relied to have the amount of money in the bag that I delivered to his house at the end of the shift be the same as the cash register said had been taken in. I didn't take any quarters and stick them, you know, out of the till and buy myself a soda with them. I used my own money to buy sodas. So I was the one guy that John, the owner, trusted. Now, one of the things I didn't like about working at the gas station is we treated black people bad. And I grew up in an area where racism was completely on the surface, although John, the owner, was more racist than most. And so at this gas station, if you were a white person, you came in, you got your gas pump, but you also got addressed as sir. We said, hello, sir. Would you like me to check your oil? We would wipe your, you know, clean your windshield. If you were a black person and you came in, you got your gas pumped. That was it. You paid the same price. You didn't get called sir, or you didn't get asked if you didn't get your windshield cleaned, and that, you know, that because of my church background, that bothered me a lot, and I felt like all I could do about it, or all I chose to do about it, was I did call you sir, I did pump your, I did you know, clean your windshield. The other guys teased me about it a lot, but that wasn't too hard to put up with. It never occurred to me that I could have said to John when I brought the money to him, you know, the reason that you trust me to bring you the right amount of money is because I follow Christ, and that's why I'm honest. And that's also the reason why I treat black people decently. So maybe you just wouldn't want to think about that connection. I mean, it never occurred to me that I had some power. I thought I was just a kid. I actually had some power, and I never chose to use it to transform my workplace. Not beyond my personal, and I'm sorry about that. I'm very sorry about that. All right, so that was kind of my entry into what does faith and work have to do together? Maybe a little bit of success and a little bit of failure in applying my faith to my work. Now, given my background, let's move on to today's readings, which I just love today's readings because they're so workplace focused. And I saw several aspects of faith and work coming out in today's readings. And so the first is access. The workplace was used as a point of access in this reading. And so I'll just read it again. On the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate by the river, where we supposed there was a place of prayer, and we sat down and spoke to the women who had gathered there. And I guess I'm assuming that this place of prayer by the river was also their workplace. So that, I might be incorrect about that, but clearly it was not a worship, it was not a sanction, a synagogue. And these women worked in the dyeing industry. So where would you do dyeing? You'd have to have a lot of water to do dyeing. So I'm assuming that this was actually, a place of prayer was actually their workplace. A certain woman named Lydia, a worshiper of God, was listening to us as she was from the city of Thyatira and a dealer in purple cloth, a luxury good. This worshiper of God in Greek is a God-fearer, and it means she was not Jewish. So there's also no reason to believe that this was, even though it was a Sabbath, there's no reason to believe it was a day off for them. because if you weren't Jewish, you worked, you know, 7 days a week in the Roman Empire. So perhaps they were at their workplace doing their dying, and they took some time to play. They gathered to pray. So I think that's kind of what's going on. And so the Lord opened her heart to listen eagerly to what was said by Paul. And when she and her household were baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come and stay at my home." And she prevailed upon us. So Paul spent some days in the city. He was a textile worker too, we know that. So he had, you know, he had access to these women through the workplace. And that's fabulous. So the access says, go to the workplace to evangelize, because that's where you can find a lot of unreached people. And when I think of the different kind of ways of thinking of work and faith, business as mission comes to mind. I think the people who do business as mission, I'm sorry, the business as mission group of Lausanne is not in our cluster, because perhaps they would correct me on my understanding. But as I understand it, the impetus of business as mission is go to where the people are, and the people are in business or workplaces. And I think factors affecting access today, business or work, provides geographic access in closed countries that will accept workers, especially business people, but not missionaries. So it's very important in our world today, just as in Paul's day. And another factor is personal access. If you work with somebody, you can usually talk to them. Most workplaces, there's some ability to talk to your coworkers. So it provides geographic access and personal access. Okay. A second reason that the workplace is important for mission is because it provides, working can support, provide support with integrity. Now I'm having to move to a different passage than the Acts passage today, but Paul says to the Corinthians, "If we have sown spiritual good among you, is it too much if we reap your material benefits? If others share this rightful claim on you, do not we still more?" The worker, Paul, as a missionary to them, says he has a right to receive material benefits from them. But, nevertheless, we have not made use of this right, but we endure anything rather than put a gospel in the way, obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. So for Paul, being supported some other way, in his case by working as a tent maker, meant he had, first of all, he could support his ministry, and secondly, he could do so with integrity, not being a burden. So if we think of support with integrity aspect of work, it provides a way to support one's needs while engaging in the mission. And the integrity aspect is it puts the missionary in the same place of life as the people among whom he or she works. They're not living a different lifestyle. And it also prevents them from being a burden on the people to whom they're preaching. And it prevents them from becoming beholden to donors or coming under suspicion of being funded by foreign imperialist agents or whatever. So it provides not just support, but support with integrity. And the aspect of faith and work that comes to my mind is tent making. Right? When I meet tent makers, I know there are tent makers here. To me, the support with integrity is a prominent aspect in the tent making movement. Now, what factors today go along with support with integrity? Well, one is if you get support by working, you're not abusing your host's hospitality. And I didn't know this before yesterday, but I've talked to some tent makers who've said, "Gosh, it just seems like an abuse to kind of take advantage of people's hospitality, for your own purposes, even if they're God's purposes." But secondly, it removes the suspicion of foreign entanglement. All right, a third aspect of faith and work is affiliation and relationships. And again, I'm pointing to another part of the gospel, the book of Acts. Paul went to see Aquila and Priscilla, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and they worked together. By trade, they were tent makers, or that word might mean leather workers, the Greek word. But he was in the tent or leather making business, and so that's how we know that Paul was a— obviously, that's where the word tent making comes from. Because he was a tent maker, he supported himself. And that gave him a relationship with Aquila and Priscilla. Now, my question is, did that also give him a relationship or an affiliate with Lydia and the women at the place of prayer by the riverside? Because he was in a similar trade, did that make them more interested in listening to him? Certainly in today's world, people are much more interested, engineers are much more interested in listening to an engineer than they are to listening to a pastor. And in fact, if you're engineers and you work together, you probably naturally develop relationships. So that's an important factor for in work, affiliation and relationships. And so, you know, did the merely working alongside the women, if indeed they did that give them an opportunity to create relationships? Remember, it says after several days, we went to where we supposed there was a place of prayer. Were they working alongside the women for several days? Now, affiliation and relationships, when I think of business as mission and tent making, both of those approaches place a high emphasis on the ability of work to create affiliation and relationships. And some factors today that are relevant for affiliation and relationships are, first of all, time, right? People spend 80 to 100,000 hours in a lifetime working. And so the potential for affiliation and relationships is high. Imagine having 100,000 hours to develop a relationship with somebody. Wow. And in fact, many people have their closest relationships at work, especially men. Most men in America do not have a close friend that they do not work with. And I don't know if that's true in other places or not. And also, good work earns the right to be heard. Right? Bad work does not earn the right to be heard. And that I'm not going to talk much more about that. But if you do good work alongside your coworkers, then you have a right to be heard, even on a topic that's not work related. If you do bad work, the more you talk about Jesus, probably the worse reputation he gets. And I'm thankful now to Stainer, who gave me this definition of tent making. He actually gave me this slide even. I appreciate that very much. Today the term tent maker is used for anyone who seeks to serve our Lord through working in another culture. Now another aspect that we see in these readings today is the transformation of the workplace. And by the way, originally, the passage that was to be discussed today was just the passage we've read so far, down by the river. And it was actually a meeting of the Lausanne Workplace Network Group that said, you know, the next part of the same passage actually is relevant too. And so Timothy guided this through, submitting to the organizers, can we move on to this, to the part about the slave girl too? And they actually changed the reading that was done in the plenary session. And so this part, I'll just read it. One day as we were going to the place of prayer, we met a slave girl who had a spirit of divination and brought her owners a great deal of money by fortune telling. Actually, maybe I won't read the rest of it because we discussed it in our table groups this morning. But as you remember, what happened is that this slave girl was possessed by a demon, this demon of prophecy that we learned about this morning. And instead of trying to heal her, her owners, you know, kept her, or certainly had an incentive to keep her in this misery because they got to make money off of her. And when Paul had the kind of compassion, or at least annoyance, that led him to cast the demon out, her employers, instead of being rejoicing, not her employers, her owners, instead of rejoicing that this woman in their care, the care of ownership, had been healed, they were angry, right? They were benefiting from her exploitation. And what it said, what this passage says to me is, I mean, it's just remarkable. Paul goes to this workplace, Paul and Silas, and Christ comes into the workplace because it's a point of access. And immediately, as soon as Christ enters the workplace, he transforms it. Right, so this woman who is an exploited, trafficked worker is healed. And the economics of exploitation are changed. So it's happens so fast that transformation follows evangelization. When Christ comes to work, it's not just a place to meet people. Christ transforms the workplace right away in this case. Now, what I wanted to do is to to introduce you or to make use of some materials from the Theology of Work project, because this passage is something that our project has considered, and in a minute I'm going to show you what we found about this passage. So if you happen to go, I left a card on your table that just shows at the very bottom our website's address. If you went to www.theologyofwork.org, you'd see this. This isn't live because I didn't want to have to depend on connectivity, but you would see, this was as of last night, you would see this page, and if you press the Book of Acts, you would, advertising, if you press the Book of Acts, you'd see this, and if you went to the table of contents and went to the confrontation over the liberation of a slave girl in Philippi, if you clicked on that, you would come to this point in the text. And I'd just like to let you know what our group, which is about 18 people from around the world working with about 40 different authors of contributors of material, found in this. The first of these two confrontations in Philippi, where Paul and Silas encounter with the spirit of divination. In the Greco-Roman world, this type of spirit was associated with fortune-telling, a connection which brought her owners a great deal of money. This seems to be an example of the grossest form of economic exploitation. It's puzzling that Paul and Silas do not act more quickly, and I know at our breakout group we were very interested in why didn't they do something more quickly. Perhaps this reason is that Paul wants to make a connection with her or her owners before correcting them. When Paul does act, however, the result is spiritual liberation for the girl and a financial loss for her owners. The owners respond by dragging Paul and Silas before the authorities. This incident demonstrates powerfully that the ministry of liberation Jesus proclaimed in Luke 4 can run counter to at least one common business practice, the exploitation of slaves. Businesses that produce economic profit at the expense of human exploitation are in conflict with the Christian gospel. Governments that exploit humans are just as bad. And we discussed earlier in this article how Herod's violence against his people and even his own soldiers led to his death at the hands of the angel of the Lord. Paul and Silas were not on a mission to reform the corrupt economic and political practices of the Roman world. That wasn't their mission. But the power of Jesus to liberate people from sin and death cannot help but break the bonds of exploitation. There can be no spiritual liberation without economic consequences. Paul and Silas were willing to expose themselves to ridicule, I'm reading below, expose themselves to ridicule, beating, and prison in order to bring economic liberation to someone whose sex, economic status, and age made her vulnerable to abuse. If we look ahead 2,000 years, is it possible that Christians have accommodated to or even profited from products, companies, industries, and governments that violate Christian ethical and social principles? It is easy to rail against the illegal industries, such as narcotics and prostitution, but what about the many legal industries that harm workers, or consumers, or the public at large? What about the legal loopholes, subsidies, and unfair government regulations that benefit some citizens at the expense of others? Do we even recognize how we may benefit from the exploitation of others? In a global economy, it can be difficult to trace the conditions and consequences of economic activity. Well-informed discernment is needed. And the Christian community has not always been rigorous in its critiques. In fact, the Book of Acts does not give principles for gauging economic activity. But it does demonstrate that economic matters are gospel matters. In the persons of Paul and Silas, two of the greatest missionaries and heroes of the Christian faith, we see all the example we need that Christians are called to confront the systems under which economic activity is conducted. So it goes beyond the personal to the systemic. All right, well, I just felt that the work we had done on the Theology of Work project was totally relevant to this passage, and I wanted to show you how you could access that material yourself we cover every book of the Bible. What does it say about work? Okay, so for this aspect, I already talked about access, about support with integrity, and now I want to talk about a transformation of the workplace. How do we know or discern which workplace practices should be affirmed and challenged? That's a difficult task. And how can we train ourselves to put achieving God's purposes above career success? Many times, following God's purposes is consistent with career success. For instance, I found as a salesman, when I went to IBM, I assumed that I was going to be in conflict with my Christian principles would be in conflict with my duties at IBM, because I thought that the way you could sell more was by selling people things they didn't need, or inflating prices, or whatever. And I learned very quickly that actually the way you sell more is by putting your customers' interests first. So I found out that Christian principles actually led to business success in IBM. But it's not always the case that Christian principles lead to success. How can we train ourselves to put achieving success, achieving God's purposes above career success? Now, transformation of the workplace, in my mind, is associated with business as mission and tent making, and also with two other approaches to faith and work called workplace ministry or marketplace ministry. Actually, that's one approach with two alternate names, and we discussed yesterday how this term that was used probably 15 or 20 years ago has kind of been morphing into this term, because not all workers would recognize themselves as being in a marketplace, whereas workplace, you know, applies to non-business and non-commercial marketplaces as well. Okay, so workplace and marketplace ministry are very interested in transformation of the workplace. What are some factors today? Well, social justice or social action are very important factors in the transformation of the workplace today. Just to name a few, poverty, women's rights, and human trafficking and bondage are all factors today. Another is environmental stewardship. And Christians, unfortunately, have been late to the table to recognize the social transformation, the business transformation required for environmental stewardship. And finally, physical, mental, and spiritual healing are factors that our workplaces need transformation. For instance, HIV, post-traumatic stress disorder, and sexual abuse, which unfortunately, the latter has occurred within the Christian workplace. The last aspect I wanted to talk about of bringing faith and work together is the meaning and value of work. And I feel like this aspect is very much underemphasized in our Lausanne community, so I just want to say a word about it. And this begins with the recognition that people were created by God to work. For whatever reason, God chose to bring his work of creation to fulfillment through the work of people, rather than to finish everything himself. So in addition to all its other purposes, work is in itself something that's important to God, human work, because he chose to finish his work through the work of people. And therefore, work and the products of work have an eternal significance in addition to the value they have in bringing people to Christ. Now, let me just say a little bit about why I believe this. First of all, God created people to help finish the creation. And I won't read the whole passage to you. But we learn that the plants of the earth had not sprung up yet, partly because God hadn't sent any rain, but also because there was no one to work the ground. So even the work of agriculture, of plants, God left unfinished, partly until he had human beings to work the ground. And then the Lord God took the man, this is before the woman was created, and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. That is the mission statement of humanity in Genesis 2:15, to work. And in Genesis 1:28, we know God said to the man and the woman, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea." So these are all work. Be fruitful and increase in number. There's two kinds of work there. One is sexual reproduction. Be fruitful and make more humans and fill the earth. But I think it also refers to the fruitfulness of, literally, fruit is right, bringing forth agricultural products and increasing productivity. Fill the earth, subdue, that's a kind of work, and rule over it. And we can't go into a whole theology of rule, but let me just say rule does not mean tyranny. If you look at what God said was good, rule, it does not mean tyranny. It means stewardship or care. And also importantly, work is the first activity where people meet God. Before anybody had any kind of set-aside places for prayer, we met God in the garden and work. God brought all the beasts and the field and birds of the air to Adam to see what Adam would name them. So God chose not even to finish naming the animals. He left that work to God. I think of that as the first work of zoology, or the first academic endeavor. And whatever the man called each one, that was its name. That was, we actually participated in bringing value to the creatures of the earth. So in addition to agriculture, the first two kinds of work were agriculture and academia. Or research, anyway. Now, although all this goodness, this work was done before the fall, so work was part of the original eternal purpose of God, but we know the fall happened. And again, I'm thankful to Stainer for this slide. What did sin do to work? Well, it separated God from work. So we no longer just naturally, if you're a bench scientist and you're researching animals, God doesn't kind of sit down next to you at the bench or at the laboratory and talk to you. Somehow our work has been separated from God. Or at least, you know, we need to be restored in order to heal the separation. There's a new hardship in work after the fall. Just relationships are destroyed. Instead of working together, we work at odds with each other. So we can't just say all work is good all the time, but we do know that work is good prior to the fall. And since the fall, it has become hard and frustrating. And the Bible's a bit more specific. One of the characteristic types of work of women is childbearing, and there's a recognition in 3:28 that that will now become painful. And for both men and women, the work of raising children is painful and difficult, in addition to being joyous and wonderful. And to the work of agriculture, it's now toil to grow crops. Thorns and thistles, unproductive stuff, occurs in addition to the productivity. And it's by the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. Now, these are given to the two activities of raising children and agriculture. But we see the fall in modern activities too, like hard disk crashes, which is an aspect of the fall that I can't wait for Christ to return, because there will be no hard disk crashes in the new heaven and new earth.
Do you need disks at that time?
Maybe. We don't know, right? I'll say a little bit more about that later. That's a terrific question. All I want to say about this is if we believe that because of the fall and Christ's work of reconciliation to heal the fall, if we believe that work is not really important anymore, all that's important is getting people saved, then I think we're ignoring the foundation of human creation, that we were created partly for work. So I would say not that work is less important. Now that what's really important is bringing people to Christ, and work is kind of less important. I'd say the opposite. There's more work to do now because of the thorns and thistles. So all the work of creating new things that God gave us in the beginning, that still exists. We still grow crops. We still research plants and animals. We still improve hard disk drives. We still brew coffee. You know, all the things that had to be done before have to be done. And things that go wrong have to be fixed. And of course, Jesus was the great physician. So work is actually more important, not less important, because there's more work to do to make the creation more like God intended. But the end of the story is hopeful. In the, I will just read this. This is a description of the heavenly city. So, right, we're all on board. Heaven is not a place that we go to permanently. It's a place maybe where we go after we die while waiting for Christ to come back. But the final home of humanity is not somewhere else. It's here. And in Revelation 21 and 22, John gets a vision of that. The new city of God is lowered from heaven to earth and becomes our eternal home. And John says this: I did not see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are in its temple. God moves back to earth. The city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives its light, and the Lamb is its lamp. Now here's the interesting part. The nations will walk in its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. What does that mean? What do the nations of the earth and their leaders bring? Maybe hard disk drives. You know, I guess if you believe that all the work we do here is destined to be destroyed in the flames, I don't know what people are bringing in then. But if instead you believe that the flames are a purifying fire, like in 1 Corinthians 3, then maybe our work is purified. And that's what we bring into the city. The splendor is our work. Now, one of my colleagues said, You can't take this too literally, because then you have to ask, well, which version of Windows is brought into the city? Not Windows ME. We know that can't possibly be in the city of God. But Windows 7, Windows 8. You know, Revelation does not give us a precise definition, but it does raise the question of does our work have meaning? You know, not just sort of something to occupy us or give us a place to access other people before Christ comes back. And likewise, it goes on and says that the honor, the glory of the nations will be brought into it. And what does that mean? On the one hand, it's praise, no doubt. The nations will give verbal praise. But perhaps we honor God and glorify God through our work. Again, from Stainer, a summary of work in the Bible is that work is an integral part of the only paradise that has yet existed, the Garden of Eden. There was work in the garden. And it's a part of the paradise that is to come, based on Revelation. Work is a gift from God. I mentioned that. It's part of God's initial intention. And that calling is repeated in the New Testament. Whoever would not work should not eat. We're called to work. Whatever you do, this is Colossians 3:23, right? Whatever you do, do it to the glory of God and not just as an eye pleaser. God has given us different tasks, and we have a calling through our work to live to Him, not only for ourselves. So work has a prominent place in the Bible. So I want to flesh this out in terms of asking, what is the meaning and value of work? Does God care about the products of non-church work? Does God care if you're a taxi driver, whether you drive a taxi well? Perhaps driving a taxi is a way to talk to other taxi drivers about Christ, maybe even taxi passengers. But what about driving a taxi well? Not running over pedestrians, not running red lights, not getting tickets, keeping your taxi well maintained and clean. Does God care about that? Does God care about maintaining the power grid reliably? I mean, even at this meeting, we've seen what happens when the power grid doesn't work reliably. Does God care about that? What about teaching mathematics? God cares about teaching religion. Does He care about teaching mathematics? Or processing building permits, if that's your job? Does God care about getting it right, whether a building permit should be passed or sent back for modification? Or what about selling toothpaste? Do these have eternal value? These questions, I think, arise most often in workplace and marketplace ministry, and another approach to faith and work called ministry in daily life. Factors that address meaning and value of work today are: there is increased job choice in many places, and thanks for bringing that to our attention, Dana, this morning. That one question is, am I in the work God wants me to be in? Lots and lots of people are asking that question. I also ask students to ask, whatever work I'm in today, what's God's calling to me today? So what's the work God wants me to do, or the profession, later? And what's the work God wants me to do in whatever job I have today? And another factor is the creative content of many jobs. At least in the developed countries, our jobs require more creative content, more of the whole person. And is that an opportunity or a challenge for bringing meaning and value of work questions forward? I want to finish by showing a 3-minute video of a young woman who I think is struggling with exactly these questions, and on the one hand, I'm pleased with some of the testimonies she gives. At the same time, I think there's some challenging questions, and not least to me, I was raised to believe that she's in the fashion industry, that fashion is kind of a waste, right? Fashion is a waste of resources, or I'm kind of from the kind of plain tradition, I guess, that there's something about adorning your body that's suspect. And she's in the fashion industry. So I love this because it brings both the challenging aspect and the affirming aspect of work to my mind. Your response might be different, but let's see what she has to say.
In Seattle, and then after that moved to New York with some friends, kind of in search of an adventure, but also for a job in the industry, and started working for Ralph Lauren not too long after I got here. and slowly got to where I wanted to be in design. And I spearhead the conceptual part of the design process and then also get to design garments until the very end. So I really am a part of the creative process from start to finish. And so I think that's a really unique part of my job, is getting to create and design something beautiful and something that's cohesive and pleasant to the eye. And yeah, I do that knowing that it's something that my creator has instilled in me. I think with any job that we're given, whether we like it or not, is meant to be done well and to the best of our ability and used as worship to our sovereign God who has placed us in that position. And I love to create, sketch things and choose colors and patterns and fabrics, and I do get to do that to God's glory, and it is a form of worship. With the design process, you're doing really similar things each season, and I think sometimes I do find myself getting a little bored, maybe anxious, and it's in those times that I realize that my job is not just for my enjoyment, but it's really for God's glory. It's meant to be done well, and I need to maintain a level of work ethic and a quality of design that I'm proud of. I think the greatest way to worship God in your workplace is by loving those that He's placed around you. And the people around me have been with me for about 3 years, and so we know each other very well, and we have many conversations about our personal lives. And it's been a really cool opportunity to be a listener, to be a friend, to love them, and to have them notice that there's something different about me. And the way that I live, and the way that I act, the way that I work, the way that I treat my boss. One morning, specifically, a coworker, who is a good friend of mine, turned around and asked, "Why are you happy all the time?" And I quickly realized that she wasn't just joking or teasing me, but she really wanted an answer. And there was a long pause and kind of this moment of like, I can give her a watered down answer, or I can really use this as an opportunity to tell her why I'm happy, and not just happy, but joyful and live with hope and purpose. And it started many a conversation. She's definitely searching for happiness, and I got to share a lot of my faith with her, and it is an ongoing relationship and an ongoing story. And I definitely think that my job is much more than just a designer. It's much more than just designing clothes. And I definitely feel called as a missionary in my workplace.